From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Born in Inner Mongolia, trained in China, violinist Xiang Yu has won some of the highest accolades in the world of classical music. Now, at 24, he's in the U.S., deepening his artistry, unfolding his own full voice as a violin virtuoso. We're curious how that works and how he sees a 21st century lifetime in classical music. Xiang Yu is with us today with his violin and his famed American teacher, Don Weilerstein. This hour on point, the 21st century virtuoso and what that means now. You can join the conversation. Do you dream of virtuosity, having it, hearing it? Will we support it in a time when so many orchestras are struggling? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Xiang Yu, now a 24-year-old violin student at the New England Conservatory of Music. He won the 2010 Menuhin competition for young violinists in Oslo, Norway. Born in Inner Mongolia, moved to Shanghai at 11, received his early training at the Shanghai Conservatory. Xiang Yu, welcome to On Point.
I'm really glad to be here.
Thank you so much for coming in. Beautiful you, beautiful your violin. Also with us is Xiang Yu's teacher, Don Weilerstein, a revered violin teacher at the New England Conservatory and the Juilliard School. Don Weilerstein, welcome to On Point. So great to have you here.
It's wonderful to be here. It's one of my favorite shows, and I listen to it 7 when it's rebroadcast.
Oh, we're so flattered. That's just fantastic. This is a great pleasure already, just hearing you on tape. What's behind us right here, Xiang Yu? What's been underneath this here? This is Brahms.
Yes, this is Brahms Sonata number 3, his last sonata, one of the late ones. Yeah.
And you accompanied there by Evan Wong.
Yes.
A lot of our music this hour, compliments of American Public Media's performance today with Fred Child. We're grateful to them for that. Mongolia? Is your family originally from Mongolia? Were you ethnic Chinese who were sent there?
I'm ethnically Chinese, and both of my parents are Chinese also, mm-hmm. but they moved to, actually my grandma and grandpa moved to Inner Mongolia about like 60 years ago during, mm-hmm. you know, the war and those times, you know, mm-hmm. the Cultural Revolution. Mm-hmm. And then we just settled there, and I was born in the capital city of Inner Mongolia. It's called Huhot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it means I think it means markets in the old times.
Of course.
It's one of the
central markets, yeah. The big town.
Yeah, and I don't live in the tents and the grassland. Yeah,
right. No yurts and no all that, but you must have seen plenty of it.
Oh,
it must surround the city.
And
the
ride
grass.
Horses also.
How soon did you, or your parents, I guess, realize that you might have a special musical talent?
I guess it was like 3-year-old or 4-year-old. I couldn't really speak fluently, but I could just copy a music line, a melody, right after I hear a song from the TV. And they thought, okay, maybe this kid has some sort of talent. So they brought me to a music teacher, and they said, oh, you have huge hands. Ah, okay, come and study maybe piano. And they said, oh, piano, too expensive, too big. And it's like, okay, violin is smaller, so let's start with the violin. Yeah, well, they didn't realize violin.
How much a Stradivarius can cost?
Oh, yes, exactly. That's the most expensive instrument in the world.
Your training in Shanghai, you moved there at age 11.
Yes.
How was your talent recognized? Were there competitions, or you got put into the conservatory there? That must not be easy. That's not open to everyone. How's that system work in China these days?
Yeah, I mean, you have to audition in the conservatory, and the teacher, I think there were like 10 teacher auditioning me, and you have to play a couple of pieces, just like college, you know, conservatory auditions. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same, except, you know, you are a lot younger. So, you know, you can be anyone. You can be anyone in the world. You know, you can be from America, you can be from Russia, you can from, you know, any part of China. And so I did the audition there. And I played some Chinese songs, and I played some scales and concertos and mm-hmm. caprices. And they thought, okay, I think Yeah, they probably thought I'm talented enough, so they accepted me. But I had to move to Shanghai from Inner Mongolia, which is a tough choice, both for me and my parents. Mm-hmm. And we did move finally when I was like 11 years old. And it's a completely different world because it's a modern city.
It's really
difficult at first.
Flash forward what must have been a very eventful 10 years or so, mm-hmm. and you are looking at coming to the States. First of all, why? Why did you decide to come and study in the United States?
Oh, because of the person who sit in front of me, Mr. Weiderstein. I'm so thrilled that he's here with me today.
Why would you go halfway around the world to study with this man?
Well, my old teacher highly, highly recommended him, and he's the only person that she recommended. That's the first. And second of all, I listened to his master class when I was in Shanghai about 2007, and I was deeply, deeply impressed. I was like, you know, I couldn't even breathe after his master class. And
what was it about what he might show you, what he offered, his way? What were you looking for? What was your teacher in Shanghai looking for that said, go to this next teacher? Mm-hmm. For what?
For me, it's to finding my own voice, looking for my own, you know, individual sound. And I think he is this kind of teacher that he doesn't tell me what exactly to do, you know, but he guides you to find your own way, and he opens the doors for you. He gives you the key, but you find your own way. It's amazing how this can work, you know.
Don, it's so great to have you here, along with Xiangyu and his lovely violin. Your institution, I mean, one of them here, the New England Conservatory, has Xiangyu in a very special status, very high status at the school.
Yes.
What did you see when you hear when you first heard him play, when you saw those big hands? Was it obvious to you that this was special talent? How did you know?
Well, a lot of this is, in a certain sense, subjective in terms of how I respond to him, in terms of whether he moves me with what he does, or I feel that he has his own special personality or something very special to say, and also whether I feel I can help him to bring out, as he said, his own voice and this sort of thing. And I heard him play first at the New England Conservatory in a smaller room, which they had the auditions in, and mm-hmm. I liked his playing very much then. And then I heard him play again at the Juilliard School, which was in a larger place. And after I heard him at the Juilliard School, which was almost consecutive mm-hmm. time, we talked a bit, and I could see that he was very enthusiastic about wanting to come to study, mm-hmm. and I also was very taken with his playing. I thought he showed a lot of depth and a lot of integrity, and he was already really very well developed as a violinist at that time, and that I could just go further in terms of bringing out his voice and being true to the music at the same time. This is terribly important to do.
What is that voice? I'll ask you both. Xiangyu, the voice, beyond technical mastery. I mean, you've won top competitions and the Menuhin and so on. You must have that mastery. What are the elements of the voice that you're looking for beyond that?
Each player has his own voice, and some of them may be, they didn't find it. They haven't found it yet. Some of them have found it. But as I listen to the old recordings, you know, when you listen to David Oistrakh and Milstein and Kreisler, you can say, oh, this is Kreisler and this is Heifetz. You know, after a couple of seconds.
You know immediately.
I just know it. But, you know, sometimes I listen to the recording today. It's all very clean and clear and it's perfection. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I just can't tell who is this and mm-hmm. who is that. So mm-hmm. This is what I'm looking for, you know, for the individual distinctive sound, just like the old masters.
How would you describe Xiangyu's voice beyond the technical proficiency, mastery perhaps?
Well, one thing that might be interesting in a general way, and Xiang also, I ask him to do this quite often, and he does it quite beautifully, is that I'll ask a student to sing for me, and see how they're responding to the music, the harmony, and the melody in it. And even if they can't sing, you know, he happens to sing very beautifully and mm-hmm. kind of operatically. Mm-hmm. And if you sing operatically, you also sing from the place when you're playing the violin that you should use, which is kind of the core, or the, you know, the diaphragm mm-hmm. deep in the stomach. And if you use that, and I encourage, of course, all the students I teach to do this, then you can get an idea, how very good idea as to how they're responding to the music, even if they don't sing. I can't sing very well
but myself. Their spirit and their character comes through
in it. And then you want to see how they're responding to the basic elements of the music and the special elements in it, too.
We're going to take a short break. Come back and hear this beautiful violin live behind us right now. Xiang Yu, accompanied by Evan Wong on piano. Again, with that violin sonata 3 in D minor, third movement. This is Johannes Brahms. We're going to hear it live, and I'm really looking forward to it. Listeners, you can join us in your daydreams. Are you a violin virtuoso, bringing the world to its knees? Do you know the actual path to that? Can you picture the path from Mongolia to the top of the heap? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with young violin virtuoso Xiang Yu about his road up from Mongolia and Shanghai, about finding a voice in classical music, about the future of classical performance in this century. One of his heroes behind us right there, Fritz Kreisler. This is 1925. He's accompanied by Evan Wong. This is Xiang Yu playing, composed by Kreisler. This is Liebeslied. Again, from performance today, and we're grateful to them for the sound. In just a moment, he's going to break out his guitar. His great teacher from the Juilliard School and the New England Conservatory, Don Weilerstein, is with us in the studio as well. You can join us. Can you picture what it means to find your personal voice on the other side of mere mastery? And what's your question for Xiang Yu on what he does, on how he does it, on how he thinks about it? What's your question for his teacher, Don Weilerstein, on how he guides young artists? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Xiang Yu, let's get a call right here. Patricia in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Thank you for calling, Patricia. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I just wanted to say, in my dreams, I am a violin virtuoso.
Me too. But only in my dreams. How about you, Patricia?
Only in my dreams. And I would like to ask, how early or how late can you start a young violinist?
I'll put that first to the teacher and then to Xiang Yu, but thank you, Patricia. Don, how early or how late can you start and maybe have the chance of blossoming into something like this?
Well, it's interesting that you ask this, in the sense that one can not only feel like that one can be, say, become a professional violinist in quotation marks, but you can also get a lot of enjoyment if you want to, you know, simply be an amateur, which of course means loving the music or whatever you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so that it's maybe it can be answered in two ways. If you want to actually be a professional player, probably I would say the latest that one can start maybe 13 or 14, but that would be very late.
Yeah.
And also that's occasionally happens when somebody has had a background in piano first, and then they would go to the violin
over
from there. But normally one starts a little bit like Zhang Yu was saying, like 3 or 4 years old, but you can start, very fine players have started like at 7, 8, maybe even 9, mm-hmm. 10 possibly. But as I say, you can start almost at any age and get a lot of pleasure out
yeah,
of it.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get this violin busy. Shang Yu, if you want to warm up a little bit,
sure.
we're going to hear from you. But as we do, I'm fascinated with this notion, more than a notion, of the voice that's beyond the proficiency, beyond the mastery even. You said, Don, that you may have Shang Yu sing sometimes a particular piece to hear. Put some adjectives, though, to his violin playing. If you think of his voice, his particular individual voice that he came halfway around the world to help deepen with you, what adjectives would you put to it?
Well, I would say it's extremely deeply felt and extremely sensitive and really creative and imaginative. His sense of timing is very unusual in the way he does everything and the way he feels the color of sound. Particularly those things, I would say, are the most special qualities of him.
Let's listen. This is Shang Yu playing Salut Amour. This is composed by Sir Edward Elgar. He has said you can almost see a rose-like blush coloring one's cheeks through listening to such charming and heartfelt music. This is 1888, but here it is live, 2013, Shang Yu. Elgar Salut Amour, live in the studio by Shang Yu. How wonderful. You're standing up cold for us and doing that. We're very grateful for it. A big smile on our virtuoso's face. There you are. Is it a new interaction every time with a piece, or do you feel like you're going down a road that you've walked many times with that particular piece, or both?
It's a combination of both. It's like an old friend. And every time you see him or her after, you know, haven't seen each other for a long time, then you you know, figure something new, you discover, wow, oh, he has something I don't know yet. You know, you just keep discovering. But I think every time I can find something new, and each performance is different. None of them are the same.
most of them not in a radio studio with mics and lights and clocks flying around.
It's a really different experience, and it's live, non-edited.
Yes, absolutely live. Oh, that's very generous of you to do.
Oh, my pleasure.
So you're on this trail to deepen this voice. Mm-hmm. If we had heard you play a couple of years ago, would it have been different?
Oh, yeah. It would be really different, I think.
Can you put words to how?
I used to be... Well, my sound was a little brighter before. Mm-hmm. And it was virtuosic, but I think now it has more depth. Mm-hmm. And it tends to have a little darker quality. Or in other words, the range is a little wider mm-hmm. than before. And I'm still searching, so yes. Maybe after 3 years, if I come back here, you will hear something different. Who knows?
I want to ask you about a stereotype that's out there in mm-hmm. at least the layman's sense of the musical world, and that is the stereotype of the brilliant Chinese musical technician mm-hmm. who doesn't have the soul. You must have heard this. You must know this stereotype well. What do you think of that? Is it insulting? Is there some truth to it when you have so many people practicing so much that some, you know, that it's harder to go on to the next step? What do you think about this this trope?
I'm used to this joke, you know, and I'm not insulting. Actually, many people, they first saw me as, oh, you must have very good technique because you're Asian. You're Chinese, Korean. And they're like, well, this is typical. But unfortunately, I'm the opposite. I don't think I'm, I'm mechanic. But I think this is maybe related to the tradition or a training tradition, which is coming from the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Many years ago, and teachers tend to make you play a lot of scales and
intense
etudes,
attention to that. Yes,
and you practice a lot mm-hmm. and make it automatic. But for me, I think it is in a way helpful, especially at the younger age. But I think as you grow up, mm-hmm. You need to look for more ways. Especially you have other things to do. You have orchestra. You have chamber music to play. You have a life. You have to read books and watch movies. You know, you need to have a life. So for me, it's important to combine all these together, not just practice. I mean, even when I'm practicing.
I've heard you don't even practice that much. I've heard you practice maybe 30 minutes a day, not hours. Is that true?
Now it's true, yes.
Does your teacher want to jump out the window when he hears that? Well, ask him.
I think he wanted to jump into the window.
I mean, well, how can you? Is it true that you only practice 30 minutes a day?
On the instruments, absolutely. Yes.
On the instrument. What do you mean by that?
Because I do mental practice all the time.
What does that mean?
Because, I need to visualize something. And sometimes, you know, if you practice in the instruments, those sound actually distracts you. So I need to be absolutely calm inside. And I think 10 times before I play once. So that's the key.
Do you have to be prepared to play, or can you be walking along the river or something when you're doing this?
Yes. When I jogging alongside Charles River, I always think about the music I'm going to play next day. Because I think it's important to combine those practice and techniques. Because, even if when you are trying to memorize a music, which is hard for most of people mm-hmm. because they only rely on the muscle memory, but mm-hmm. I think I combined the visual memory and audio memory and muscle memory
all together. Go through it mentally. So, listeners, what do you hear in this voice, this wonderful voice? Let's go to Mare calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Mare, you're on the air with Xiang Yu.
Hi, dear musician.
Hi.
Really, while I was listening to your last piece you played, mm-hmm. it was like you are painting a beautiful artistic piece. It was, to me, like you are moving a brush, really artistically.
Thank you.
Really, I never heard before in any concert, any other piece of music. I'm a fan of the Mozart, but really the work you performed, it was really like I can see the movement of the artistic brush. I say congratulations to you.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so flattered to hear that. Wow.
Professor,
thank you.
Yeah. I wish you the best of the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you for calling from New Orleans. Don, what about metaphors like this? When you're working with young artists, is it helpful to think of a paint, a brush, a canvas, or...?
Yes, it is actually very helpful. And as a teacher, I try to find the metaphors that can communicate the most, and for each student it can be different. And that's one of the wonderful things about teaching is the variety that you can experience this way. Very often one thinks of the bow particularly like a paintbrush. I use that analogy very often. And it's often very useful because actually the way the bow hair works on the strings, there's so-called little bristles in the hair.
There's the connection.
And then one. It makes the string vibrate, mm-hmm. just like, and then in a sense, then the string is like the color, and you spread the string color with a paintbrush that you're using, this kind of thing.
So he's working on his bow, and voice. He's working on his music and its voice. But you're the teacher. In a way, you're working on him. How are you – this isn't just a technical conversation.
No,
it's almost
no.
– it's a philosophical, it's an artistic conversation. How do you – you're famed for bringing this out. How do you do it? What's your secret? What's your approach?
Are you Zen?
You just sit and let him figure it out? Or do you give him – do you articulate
ask him or other students what character they would like. I try to work always from the music. This is very important. And then what their individual response is to the music. But in doing that, you're looking at the musical structure and the various harmony and the melody that brings it out in the counterpoint. And the rhythm, of course, is terribly important too. And so that I ask them questions about this sort of thing related to musical character a lot, but also maybe I'll have them even conduct or clap the rhythm or count it in the way they feel it. And of course, this is all to communicate the music. It's interesting that in terms of virtuosity, that in a way, I guess one could say that one wants to be a virtuosic communicator, but in a way what one is really doing is that you want to move the people with music. And one can be moved by the brilliance of it, but it's also wonderful to be moved by the soulfulness and the depth of it and the wonder, deep feeling that the composer wrote it from.
That and the musician, him or herself. Shengyu, you've said people in a way what they want to hear is the heart of the musician, the person on the violin.
Yes.
So when they listen to yours, if your voice is merging here, are we hearing Mongolian grasslands? Are we hearing Shanghai skyscrapers? Are we hearing some lullaby your mother sang you? I don't know. What's in that voice?
I think different people may have different, imaginations. That's what it's amazing about music. You know, if you go to a concert hall, you listen to a performer's playing, and, 10 people can have 10 different ideas about what they're talking about. If I'm listening to it, maybe I see Mongolian grassland, maybe when Mr. Watterson listened to it, it's going to be, San Francisco, California Sea. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it can be very different, but it's the same music. That's why this is amazing.
Are you, when you're playing, are you thinking about the composer, their intention? Are you thinking about your own soul, your own mood?
I think it's important to really respect the idea of the composer. And always, the composer always comes first. And what I'm saying is that behind the black notes and white papers, there is the soul of the composers. I'm trying to, see the things behind the papers and find why they are putting an accent here and why he wanted a forte here and why he wants a crescendo here. I'm trying to ask myself. At the same time, I'm trying to ask the composer, even though, the composer won't answer me. Like, I can't really make Beethoven back to life. But
he may. He left some words, some messages there on paper. Yes. Shengyu, please stand by. We're going to put that violin to work again when we return. And Don Weilerstein, it's great to have you both. We're talking with young violin virtuoso Shengyu. This is a Chaconne composed by Tommaso Antonio Vitali. 17... 720 800-423-8255. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We have a great pleasure this hour of talking with young violin virtuoso Sheng Yu about his road up from Inner Mongolia and Shanghai, about finding a voice in classical music. We want to talk about the future of classical performance here a little bit as well. More Elgar there, back to 1888. Boy, does that sound fresh and wonderful today. Salute the Moor, the title translates love's greetings. Yes, you can join us. What's your question? For our virtuoso, for his teacher, Don Weilerstein, who's with us in the studio as well. And where will talent like this go as symphonies struggle lately? What's the 21st century place for this music in our society? We're at 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. We'll hear more live in just a moment. Evan Wong, accompanying Sheng Yu there behind us. People writing in. Charles writes, if I were an artist, I believe I could draw an accurate portrait of Sheng Yu from simply hearing him play. He says, graceful, beautiful, and secure enough in his talent to only bow strongly enough to coax the necessary notes out of the violin, and no more. Superb, he says. So there you go. Kudos. Kudos from the audience. Linda's calling from Vernon, Vermont. Linda, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Our high school, Lillen and Gray Union High School in Townsend, Vermont, has a Journey East exchange program for over 10 years with students from Hoha, Inner Mongolia University.
Oh, from Sheng Yu's hometown.
Wow, I know that university.
It's a huge city. It's over 2 million people and borders the Gobi Desert.
Mm-hmm.
And we have had students in our home, and I've watched them perform, and my granddaughter has gone there, and my grandson will go there next year.
Wow.
And these students start their art education intensively at a very early age. And the young people have told us that they practice 6 to 8 or more hours a day when they're learning to be proficient. One of the reasons that they can do that is their country values the performing arts. Something that we don't put money into, but they do. And you can really see the difference in the students and their dedication, and we've been honored to have them here in our home. And I'm so honored that you have Sheng Yu on your program.
Linda, we're so happy to hear from you. And Sheng Yu's hearing that connection to all those students from Hohhot right there in Inner Mongolia. Thank you, Linda.
Make me homesick. Thank you.
Listen, I wonder about that, though, because you must be aware of this. Anybody in musical circles in this country is the pressure that many American symphony orchestras have been under has been intense. Many of them have struggled. Some have gone bankrupt.
Yeah.
They've had, you know, labor strife lately, San Francisco and Minneapolis?
Minneapolis also, yes.
Now, maybe you're so high on the pecking order that it won't matter to you. Maybe you're at the top of the heap and it won't matter. But what about it? Do you imagine that more of your musical life will be in the West or the East, in the United States or in China? Maybe China, as Linda says, values it so much and such a booming economy, so many big cities. Maybe China will have 100 symphony orchestras and plenty of venues for someone like you to perform. What do you think in your lifetime?
I would say that, China is developing so quickly and anything could happen. But I think for classical music, we still need some time to develop an audience. And it is true that, you know, there are more music schools and more orchestras, you know, keep coming to China. And as for the, recent strike of the San Francisco and also the Minnesota ones, I sort of got used to it because this is getting more and more as the time goes on. And as a musician, because I'm not a politician or economics, things like this, but I think it is easy to sit there and complain about, classical music today is going downward and nobody wants to go to concert hall to listen to you and blah, blah, blah. But I think it is important to just be quiet and start doing something. For me, the most important thing as a performer is to develop a potential group of audience. For example, I've done some outreach in concert and playing in high schools and middle schools and playing for those young people, of course, for free. And people will say, are you crazy? You're not getting paid and you're performing for them? I said, oh, this is our future. See, whenever I go to a concert, 99% or 90%, that's a little bit exaggerated, 90% of the audience are like seniors, you know, older people, which is great, but you know, you need young people to come to the audience.
You're young. You need the ones who will be around in your life.
I need somebody like in my age, then, you know, when I grew up and perform, I need an audience. So, you know, we need an audience group, like a younger age.
Don, what are the venues going to be for Sheng Yu's generation of virtuoso? What's the audience going to be?
Well, I think that actually the best thing that we can do as musicians is constantly try to develop these types of venues. They're actually going out into different places now. People are playing even in cafes. I shouldn't say even. You can take it out of the symphony hall and that's that sort of thing. But I think in a way the most important thing is to continue to develop people's love for the music and for them to realize how much they can feel soulfully and with their emotion, how they can relate to it. We had a wonderful experience. I have a trio with my wife and daughter, and we played in Joplin, Missouri, which would think of a sort of out-of-the-way place. Of course, they had a
disaster. Well, lots of music, but not much classical music.
Yeah, but actually they have, in that city, a really nice music program, but they bust them into hear us give a young people's program. And then as we were playing, we asked the kids what they felt as we were playing. And I was astonished again to realize that they really did respond to the joy or the sadness of it, or they felt like they were scared at times, or that they were excited by something and this sort of thing. So that if people realize that it's such, in a way, the best parts of us, in a sense, are what come out in this type of music performance, I think it's fantastic. And then there'll be much more support from the government and also from the people.
Let them hear it. Let them feel it. Anne in New Haven, Connecticut. Anne, thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on the tremendous marriage of the technical and the heart, in that the very brief performance that if you had asked me, could have gone on all day long. It was moving and beautiful, and it's not often out there in all of the classical performers. They're generally technically brilliant, but lack the heart, and you could just feel the heart come through.
Anne, we're going to give you more of that right now. We'll do it right now. Shangyu, you've got another piece here. Let's give Anne more of what she's calling for. You've got a piece by Monty. Tell us about this piece before you stand up to play.
This is probably a popular piece among the audience because it's quite effective and it is virtuosic. Finally, we match the title today.
This is it's a Csárdás.
Csárdás.
It's 1904.
It's a Hungarian dance. It's all coming from the Hungarian folk songs with a slow, rhapsodic, free introduction and then followed by a fast dance, almost like a tarantula.
Will you play it for us?
Sure, I'll
Great.
Try.
All right. Off come the earphones and the violin, lovely caramel-colored violin at the chin of Sheng Yu. We've got another mic up high here in the studio, just beneath our clock and big red light. He takes his position and, Monty's Csárdás. Yes! Xiangyu, thank you, thank you, thank you. He's cold. Well, it's good. It's our good fortune either way. Wonderful, wonderful. It almost like a flute up in that high air. And the way we're mic'd, we can hear the horse here right on your strings. It's very clear. Caroline in New York, Westchester County, New York. Caroline, you're on the air with Xiangyu just out of his Vittorio Monti.
Yes, and I'm trying very hard to breathe.
Yeah.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I grew up in a very musical family. My father played the violin, and I studied voice from the age of 10 as a coloratura. And when I've talked to people about the violin, in discussions of what was my favorite instrument, for me, it has always been the violin. The violin sings and it dances, and for me, when I can not sing, when I cannot express my soul, the violin does it for me. When I listen to a virtuoso like Shonin, my spirit absolutely soars, and I have to say thank you for creating this beautiful music.
Caroline, we're right there with you. Thank you. Thank you so much for that. You know, we know it's not always soaring. We know the famous story when you were headed to the Minuin competition and a couple of years ago in the big volcano out of Iceland. You were trapped there. Mm-hmm. What ended up getting picked up by the local former ambassador to China and Norway. And
yeah.
Slapped onto an Icelandic air flight up in one of the cockpit seats with the pilots.
With the pilots.
to make it to your performance there. And is it true that when you first came to the States, you auditioned in pajamas and slippers because your luggage was lost?
Oh, wow. Where did you get that rumor? But it's true, yes. Yes, because I think somebody took my shirts, you know, and performing audition dress, you know, in the airplane. I couldn't find it, and I just can't wear those sneakers and sleeping shirts, and I had to apologize, and I still remember what Mr. Wadison said, "Thanks for letting us know."
Your luggage is gone.
My luggage is gone. And I played like a Chinese violin, very cheap violin. But I think it went well.
What's your dream of a career in this century in violin? What shape would you like it to have? What do you dream of, hope for?
Actually, I really, really wanted to be a soloist and a teacher at the same time. It sounds ideal, but I'm going to really try hard for that.
It's a compliment to your teacher right here and other teachers you've had that you want to do both.
Yes, I wanted to do both because I really, really would love to devote what I have to the next generation or even to my generation. And, you know, because as a performer, you may sometimes experience something difficult and you can, you know, you had a hard time finding your way and finding the solution. But I think if I can help someone or a group of people so that they don't repeat the same mistake I had to experience, so they save time and go even further.
And what's your guess about the bulk of your years? Will they be in the United States, in Europe, in China, spread all over the world? What's your guess?
I think for the next couple of years, I'm going to stay in the U.S. I'll try to stay in the U.S. because first of all, I really, really enjoy living in Boston. That's number one. And number two, I think this is a very healthy market for me. I mean, despite of all the, you know, the problems we had. But I think it's still a very healthy market.
Then back to China, or
back to China? I'll think about that later because I still need to learn a lot more and need to grow up.
We like the way you're growing, just fine, just fine. Don Weilerstein, violin teacher at the New England Conservatory in the Juilliard School. Don, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Xiangyu, thank you for your beautiful performance. Thank you for your devotion to the music. Thanks for being. Thanks for being here.
This is my greatest pleasure.
Thanks to our music on tape today from American Public Media's performance today with Fred Child. And thanks to all of our callers. We got a little more of Evan Wong and Xiangyu. Poem from Chausson, 1896. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.